Good morning, and thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and we're here every Saturday morning from 9 until 10. If anyone is listening and has questions or comments, you can give us a call at 520-790-2040. So we're going to jump right in. We have two wonderful guests today, Carl Leopsen and Amanda Tashjian.
Very close.
Okay. So Carl is the head of the Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies in the College of Education, which I hear has more degrees available than any other.
More accredited programs. We have more accredited programs in our department than there is in any one department.
In the entire university?
Yes.
That's amazing. And also, Amanda is an assistant professor of practice, also in the Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies, and she's here to talk about Talk It Out, the partnership between the department and TUSD, which provides free counseling to TUSD students. Also, a small shout-out to Bruce Burke, who is the new TUSD board member. Hmm. So, thank you guys for joining us.
Sure.
And I'm really fascinated in your bios. So I know, Carl, you used to teach.
I did.
A gazillion years ago. Or five.
It's become a long time ago, hasn't it? Yeah. So I'm from the Midwest, from Kentucky. And after I left high school, I went to college. So this is part of a story I always tell my grad students.
Okay.
But things can actually work out for people because I quit school. I quit college. I was bored. I was doing things I probably oughtn't do, which is why I also have a soft spot for kids who are in trouble. And I left and joined the Marine Corps. So I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. Got out and thought, what on earth am I going to do with my life? And I remembered back to teaching swimming lessons and that being one of the happiest times that I had spent. You got to do problem solving. You got to hang out with people. And it was wonderful. So I jumped into a degree in teaching, and I used my GI Bill. And I was at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. A big shout out for anybody who's from South Carolina. Wonderful place. And got my degree there, started teaching, got my master's degree at the University of Kentucky. They invited
me. So how old are you when you go back?
Oh, you know, so I'm older and more serious students. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps.
Right. So you leave the Marines.
So I was probably about 24, 25.
20, okay.
Yeah. And then I was invited to come to the University of Kentucky and get a master's degree in assistive and adaptive technology. This is back in the dinosaur days of computing with the Apple IIc and devices like that. We were learning to take computers apart and put in cards and build switches for kids to help them access computers.
So you were building the...
Building switches, turning electronic toys into switches so that kids with limited mobility could access computers or have fun.
Mm-hmm.
Doing assessments of kids so they could access computers. But this was the old days, right? This was the early 90s. And I did well there. I started working in a district as a behavioral consultant, right? So there were some people that knew I had a background in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And they got hold of me, and this was before there were many behavioral consultants in districts. It's pretty common now to have somebody who runs around a school district or a whole team of people that solve behavioral challenges. But this didn't exist at that time, especially in central Kentucky. And so they got hold of me and they said, hey, we've got this job. Why don't you write a job description for it and come interview? I figured I could get that job as long as I wrote the job description. And I did that for several years. until I was invited back to the University of Kentucky to get my degree, my PhD. And when I finished my PhD, this job at the University of Arizona was available, and I, on a lark, sort of came out and interviewed, and been here ever since. We love it here. My wife and I love it here. Shout out to my wife, Patty, who is also a teacher and actually works on an intervention team in Sunnyside.
Wow. Yeah. So I have never thought of Kentucky as the Midwest.
Yes.
And also, what happened to the swimming? You went back to school because you like swimming.
Oh, because I was I grew up as a swimmer, and so
I taught
swim
lessons.
Did you
ever teach swimming?
Oh, my God. So
did
the
you
Seminole,
teach my nephew how to swim?
I wish I could have. I taught a lot of swim lessons, but people, when I started teaching swimming, I had one family reach out to me with a kid who was deaf,
mm-hmm.
And I had the coolest time adapting what I knew to help teach a kid who was deaf how to swim. And then other parents with kids with disabilities started to reach out to me to teach swim lessons. And then there was a...
And now you had a department that oversees deaf studies.
There you go. There was a whole... So there was this is back when we used to have adults with intellectual disabilities and the problems. You group them in facilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was one of those facilities, one of the oldest in the country, was in Lexington, Kentucky. And they would bring adults for swim lessons out to, and it wasn't even as much lessons as just kind of goofing off. Well, there was this big guy, and this is radio. I'm not a big guy, but there was this big guy. He must have been 6'2", 6'3". And he had limited communication, and he would just walk himself up to the top of the high dive and jump off and sink like a rock to the bottom of the pool. And I would dive in and fish him out and pull him to the side, and he would go and do it all again. Most fun working with kids and working with people with disabilities. Figured out how to do. And it's been great. It's been great. And the job I have now is the best job in the world for someone like me. It really is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amanda.
Yes.
I don't know if you can top the guy jumping in.
I don't know that I can.
Saving him every time.
I don't know that I can. My story is not nearly as fascinating as Carl's. I did fall into rehabilitation counseling and working with people with disabilities, though. I'm from Michigan, so what I consider the real Midwest, East Coast Midwest. And I did my undergraduate studies at the University of Michigan, and I was a typical, you know, I wanted to go to med school, but I really liked going out and hanging out with my friends compared to studying for my chemistry class. And so psych was easy for me. I got it. It mm-hmm. jived. I understood it really well, and I stuck with it. And I ended up minoring in sex and gender studies because of a fluke. I ended up in an upper level course on the sociology of sexuality. And the professor said, well, you're not supposed to be here. This is for upperclassmen. And I said, well, can I just stay? I like the material. I think I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, okay, let's see how you do. The ad drop deadline hasn't passed. And she liked me, and she gave me the opportunity, and I stayed. And I loved it. And then it was, let's take the sociology of gender course. And so I built out my own minor, and I loved it. Well, knowing that I wanted to be a doctor of some kind, I ended up applying to graduate school, but not medical school. And I wasn't sure about a PhD because it was so much time invested, and I didn't really know what that meant so much outside of practicing as a psychologist. So I applied to a bunch of PsyD programs and this Master's of Science program at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Rehabilitation Counseling. I had no idea what that was. All I knew was that it talked about understanding medical aspects of disability. And I come from a family of people who are in the medical field, and I like diagnostics. I like the medical stuff, mm-hmm. and I like the how and why and what people are But I like the factoid behind it. And so diagnosis made sense to me. It was clear and concise, and it led to intervention. And that was all I was curious about. So I interviewed at these PsyD programs, and I was royally disappointed because it was all clinical work and no research. And I figured, well, what if I want the opportunity to do research? I'm not going to know what to do. This doesn't seem great. And then I had my interview with this master's program, and the man who interviewed me was Pat Corrigan, who at the time I didn't know, now I know, is the world's leading researcher on psychiatric stigma. And I Googled him
after. What is psychiatric stigma?
So with mental health, we stigmatize mental health in general for a lot of different reasons. But really what he looks at and what we mean by psychiatric stigma is how we feel, think, perceive people with very serious mental illness, which from a disability standpoint is a section or cluster of disability. And I was fascinated by his research, and I figured, okay, I'll go. I got in. Let's see how this works. I panicked for a semester because I didn't understand how counseling differed from psychology, and I didn't understand why we kept talking about disability and vocational work and placing people in jobs. And I rushed into it. And long story short, I bought into the program and I loved it. And they suckered me in to stay for my doctorate. And so I stayed.
And here you are.
And here I am.
Okay, we're going to go for a quick break right now, and we'll be back and to talk more about this Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies. We'll be right back. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we're here with Carl Leopsen and Amanda Dashian, both from the Disability and Psychoeducational Studies at the College of Ed. And Carl, I was wondering if you could give us an overview of the department.
Sure.
Because of all the things it oversees.
Oh.
You don't have to list them in order, but just an overview of the department.
When I took over this position, so I've been at the university now for 19 years, but this is my second year as the department head. And I found that it was really important at every meeting I would go to at the university to just tell people everything we do. There were always amazed faces and gasps from folks simply because we're a large and diverse group. So it's about 70 faculty and staff. We have all of the research and programs in all of the areas of special education, and there are several of those.
Is there a broad definition for special education?
Oh, sure. We can get into that
later. Okay.
Yeah, let's get into that later. There are other areas too. So we have all of the special education programs and research and faculty. We have the school psychology research and faculty and programs. We have the counseling programs, and that's rehabilitation counseling, mental health counseling, and school counseling. And we have all of the ASL, or American Sign Language, and educational interpreting programs. So it is a big and bustling place. Fabulous faculty, right? And fabulous programs. So Amanda is doing this wonderful job for us at our master's program in counseling. She is running the fourth-ranked program in the country in U.S. News and World Report for counseling.
That's wonderful. So on the counseling front, what is... because you mentioned that the department has helps people become counselors and school psychologists. What is the difference between school counselors, school psychologists, and there's one other, social worker?
Ah, good question. So I'll go top down is probably the best way of describing this, because they are sort of, everything in behavioral health is somewhat overlapping. If you think of a nice big Venn diagram, we all have a little piece of the puzzle that kind of overlaps. But school psychologists...
What's a Venn diagram?
Really? If I carve out A Venn diagram is a diagram that looks at multiple factors or entities, and we see where those entities overlap or have commonality. And so we can look at two things, like school psychology versus school counseling. In this case, we're looking at three pieces, maybe more, but school psychology or school psychologists, social workers, and then school counselors. And the common theme that they all share is, generally speaking, servicing children. School psychologists tend to do a lot of assessment and diagnostics with regards to learning disabilities and behavioral needs of kids in K through 12 settings. Their job is more often than not to figure out what is going on. And I don't want to say what the problem is, but we are looking at something that's more diagnostic in nature. School psychologists have a direct tie to the parents and family with regards to that information, as well as helping to set up individualized education plans for a kid. A school social worker might come in. Social workers, I always think of as the connectors. Without social workers, we have very limited access to resources that might be needed. So they're the person that might be providing a family or a student with information regarding food services, other support in the community, whether it's social support, parenting skills classes. They might be working with more acute needs, so kids who have involvement with DCS or Child Protective Services, working with families who are under custody orders. They also do things in the school to make sure that the school at large, the kids in particular, are aware of things like bullying, for example, what's appropriate, what isn't appropriate, healthy social skills and boundaries between parents and kid and teacher, those types of things. Mm-hmm. Social workers tend to know what's going on in the community as it relates to the school and the kids and families.
So if a parent had a child that they were worried about, how do they choose who to self-refer to?
Sure. So this is where school counselors come in, because a lot of times what happens is, and the reality is, kids are at school most of the day, probably more than they're at home or sleeping. That's usually the balance. It's sleep and school more than anything. A lot of times what will happen is a child will interact with the school counselor because they're their touch point when there is a problem in the classroom before going to the principal's office or anything like that. So if there's an educational barrier or problem going on, something with regards to a peer interaction or something more significant, whether it's behavioral, emotional, or dealing with the family system, a lot of times the school counselor is that touch point. School counselors are meant to be that support both academically and behaviorally and emotionally. A school counselor will often refer to or pull in the school social worker or school psychologist as they see fit or as they deem as necessary because of the kid's need. If that makes sense.
Yes.
Okay.
So in your department, you train all three of these.
Yes. Well,
we don't do social work.
We don't do social work. That actually belongs to another college.
Yes. Even school social workers.
Yes. Yeah.
Another college. Okay. So what does it take to become a school psychologist?
We have three programs. We have a program that is a PhD. EDS, and
which
we also
stands
have
for?
Another program, which is an Ed Specialist, which it's along the same line as a PhD, but with less of research experience. Usually, generally meant to prepare practitioners at a doctoral level.
Yes.
So we have our program here. We have a program in Chandler for school psychologists. That's really been growing and bustling. What does it take to become a school psychologist? It's a long and it's a hard road.
Lots of practice with assessments.
I will tell you, it's a lot of assessment.
When you say assessments, do you mean like standardized tests, or do you mean something else?
Both standard more informal. Right, so they'll use a variety of material.
Yeah, it's a combination. When we think of like the best case scenario for an assessment protocol, whether mm-hmm. it's school psychology or clinical psychology, or even in my world, what we do with our counseling students, whether they're school counselors or rehab and clinical mental health students, ideally assessment is a combination of multiple tools that we're using to get the full picture of strength and limitation of an individual. So we use standardized measures. And I say measures or tests because a singular test does not make for an assessment. But the other thing we do a lot of is observation, both in classroom, at home, collecting information from parents and teachers regarding the behavior, emotional function, social interaction of a kid. So it's a collective way of really looking at what's happening, what's working, what isn't working. Mm-hmm. But we do that in a way that's as comprehensive as possible to best suit the need of that kiddo.
That's a general format used by school psychologists, counselors, school counselors,
now,
teachers.
The School Counselor Association has a number that they believe should a ratio for counselor to student. And we are over that in Arizona.
We are. The national average, I think, is one school counselor to 455 students. In Arizona, it's one school counselor to 905 students.
But isn't the recommendation they have 1 to 250?
Yes.
So, do you think, right, we hear a lot about teacher shortage, and it seems on that end, it is teachers not wanting, you know, not being able to go into the classroom, and they can't fill those spots. Is that the same thing with counselors?
I think we have a lot of school counselors. We have a lot of people who want to be school mm-hmm. counselors. I think the system isn't terribly supportive of school counselors. We could. I don't know that we want to, but there's the financial reasons for the pay of a school counselor is disincentivizing in a lot of ways. We have a particularly unique program in that our school counselors are eligible for state licensure as a general licensed counselor upon graduation, which is unique in that our program believes in training our school counselors to have some knowledge and emphasis around diagnosis and intervention above and beyond what a school counselor would be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So their breadth of knowledge is deeper and vast, and they have the skills to do all of this great work, although in a school setting, that work is limited. I think our classroom size and the way schools are structured plays a huge role in why those ratios look that way. I would also say that the awareness and acceptance of what goes on for a child and a family is complex. I think some people think that school is school. You go to school to get your education and you leave and go do your own thing. And that's not what we see happening for a lot of kids and families. And there needs to be more support. But that's a challenge when you can only take so many minutes with a singular child. And a lot of our students come into the program with two thoughts. One is, I know these ratios are totally out of whack, but that's a problem, and I'm here because I had a school counselor who took the extra time to work with me, and that made a difference in my education, and that made a difference in terms of my emotional stability because home was really challenging. So I want to do what my school counselor did for me. But the other part of that is the awareness that the ratios are pretty funky and they want to service their community.
We have. That's one reason why my job is one of the best jobs in the world. I get to work with so many people who are so passionate about what they want to do, whether it is in school psychology or school counseling or in a teacher in special education. A lot of the folks that we get now into our special education teaching programs were people who had some connection with special education when they were in school. Either mm-hmm. they received some services or they worked with kids who were in special education. And like Amanda says, these people had this really deep passion for service and for improving the lives of and the community, people around them.
One thing that you and I had talked about before the show yesterday,
yeah.
Is that there are some people that don't understand. They see their kids in their classroom and they see one person who's working with a single child. And do you want to talk about what that person is, explain what that person is actually doing so that...
So there are times in special education services where there is a need to meet the needs of that kid, mm-hmm. requires something just very specialized, right? And there's a real focus to have inclusive services for kids, and that means, and it's actually a requirement under the law that kids with disabilities be served to the greatest extent possible with kids in the general education environment.
And the law is a federal law?
It is a federal law passed in 1975.
Oh, is that the IDEA?
That is the IDEA. It is.
The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And we will be right back to discuss this. And thanks, guys.
Hi, we're back. You are listening to Smart Talk. And our guests today are from the Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies, which is part of the College of Education.
And we have the head of the department, Carl Liepsen, and also an assistant professor of practice, who's Amanda Tashian.
You got it.
Okay. So we are going to talk a little bit about special ed and IDEA. So in 1975, as Carl mentioned, the Individuals with Disability Act was passed, and at that time, Congress agreed to pay 40% of all costs. So far, they then changed the law a few years later and said no more than 40%.
Right.
So, which they thought gave them a little leeway, but not in many people's minds, just in their own minds. And currently, the federal government has never paid more than 17%.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Which leaves the burden, and we should be educating these kids, and we should be doing everything required by IDEA, but it leaves the burden of costs on the states. In a state like Arizona, where we give so little to education, it's a huge burden.
It leaves the burden on the districts. I will tell you this. Special education is not a moneymaker. You can talk to any district person, just because there's money available for services for these kids, it is no boondoggle. They actually, because of the way it's funded, they are dipping deeper. And they actually have to dip usually into their general funding to provide these services, because these services are required by law.
Mm-hmm.
Right? An individual
has
planned.
So they have to dip into the general general ed students.
Yeah, so if somebody says, well, what would you do if they actually funded IDEA? Well, we would use that money uh-huh. for special education services, and we'd have money available also for general education services. And I'm not saying that one is stealing from the other. We're trying to meet the needs of everybody.
Right, and it stretches
and we
those
get shortchanged
budgets
this way.
Then.
We've gotten shortchanged.
Now, years ago, when my kids were in school, some districts weren't able to provide special education services, so they would send them to another district. When they send them to another district, do they get the full amount, or do they get the minimum amount that comes from the state?
So every public entity is required to provide services. They don't have a choice. Now they could have some agreement with a neighboring district or elsewhere to provide services. There are also, and this happened more back east. I taught in Pennsylvania for a little while. They will
is
have.
Is that also in the Midwest?
That is for me. The Midwest is a big place. They would have special ed services that were provided to multiple rural areas at once, so they would kind of combine them all in one spot. So do they get the full amount? They get what they need to provide services. So one thing to remember is, and keep in mind, is the money doesn't follow the kid. So I think people imagine, so this kid is identified for services. Where's this kid's money? Where's their account they can draw from for books, and where does the teacher go? The money comes in big lump sums to the district for all of the kids. And then the district chooses how to apportion it to meet the needs of all those kids. Maybe they need a new bus. Maybe they need some paraprofessionals, some people who spend time one-on-one with a kid during part of the day, one-on-one with another kid, and then with a small group of students, and maybe does some supervision in another spot. Maybe they need curriculum that they're going to use for multiple kids. Maybe they need equipment. And the district and the special ed director and their finance folks have to figure out how to stretch this money that has come to service all of these kids, how to spread it amongst all those kids.
And I've heard from superintendents that they are doing exactly what you said.
Yeah.
They are stretched, and so they are going into general funding.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the programs that you that are happening in your department, because they are so amazing and wonderful and exciting to hear about.
It just makes me bust. I'll tell you what, that is another reason why this is one of the best jobs ever for a person like me. Every single day, I have amazing faculty and staff walking into my office and coming up with incredible ideas. And they say, well, how can we kick this off? And I get to help them get things going, kick problems out of the way for them. And they go and they just get it.
Okay. So why don't you tell us about the ASL, American Sign Language, dual enrollment program? Because this is super cool.
It is really cool. Dr. Cindy Folk, just a wonderful person and faculty member in our program. So she has arranged this dual enrollment with high schools.
Mm-hmm.
So our ASL program at the University of Kentucky's, I mean, at the University of Arizona is a large program. So American Sign Language can be considered as a language requirement for students at the university. It's a very popular set of programs. So to encourage students in high school to get some of that out of the way for their college experience, we have arranged, I think it's currently with Marana School District, so that students who are taking a year of American Sign Language in high school with their instructors, they pay a very small fee. It's an incredibly ridiculously reduced tuition rate. But their year in high school counts as their first semester of ASL at the University of Arizona.
And do you have a professor going out there? Do you do it by video?
No, the instructors who are at the high schools actually come in and get some training with Dr. Volk. So
and
we
then
have
go
some
back.
Consistency with our curriculum at the University of Arizona.
Okay.
Oh, they have excellent instructors out there in the high schools. Yeah.
So,
And there's already over 50 students taking advantage of this.
That's great.
And first
50
year,
students
we just
at Marana. That's
yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And this is the first year?
It is.
That is
yeah.
Great. Another program I wanted to ask about, since there's such a need in Arizona to provide mental health services to our students, and since there's been such drastic cuts to public education, your department has started the Talk It Out Project to provide mental health services to students and their families. And can you do 2 minutes? Tell us about it.
Yes, absolutely. So my colleague, thanks. Dr. Leah Falco, really spearheaded this, and this has been in the making for the last 2 years or so. Long story short, we ended up with this great partnership with TUSD, who already has built an infrastructure for our counseling program to come in, provide mental health counseling services to TUSD kids and their families. And this
that's
happened.
So great.
It is. And it's really because they have family resource centers, and there's 4 of them, and they're located throughout the district. So we had already sites that were providing wraparound services in a sense. And when I say wraparound service, I mean things like parenting classes, second language classes, food support, food pantry, clothing bank, school supplies, and we came in and said, well, we can give you free services that are really challenging for families to access because mental health care is challenging to access, especially in Arizona. We also know that about half of people who are diagnosed with a mental health disorder are diagnosed before the age of 14. And so we see that especially in the middle school, high school range.
So is it a drop-in program or do people make appointments or how does it work?
So we knew that we'd have a great need and we knew that we'd need to do some scheduling because we're at four sites. We have multiple students providing counseling. I'm the clinical supervisor.
And these are graduate students.
These are graduate students in our counseling program, in our master's program. We do have drop-in services available. So each of the four family resource centers has an extended day where they stay open till 8 p.m. And there's a coordinator there who, if somebody walks in and needs support, we're pretty able to take them in and get them with a counselor right away. But we're also scheduled and we're fully booked. Last I talked to our coordinator, who's a former graduate who stayed on with us, and we've recently hired a full-time coordinator, which is very exciting, with some grant funds that we received, because we definitely need the help from the supervision standpoint in building out the program. We are servicing, it's over 400 referrals at this point, and we haven't fully advertised to TUSD at all.
Wow.
And we're seeing everyone from kindergarten through 12th grade, as well as family members. So it's pretty incredible that we're able to provide a service that, if we were to refer to the community, could take somebody 6 weeks, 8 weeks to receive an actual counseling appointment with a therapist, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that is great. We have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we're going to talk about Project Focus. We'll be right back. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and our guests today are, one is the head of the Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies at the College of Ed, Carl Liepsen, and the other is an assistant professor of practice, Amanda Tashkin. So we were talking about Project Focus, which serves, it's a transition program for students who have autism.
And other developmental disabilities, I believe.
Yes.
Intellectual disabilities.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Dr. McFarland, who runs the program, has actually taken some of our students in the master's and counseling program for mostly internship to do some hours of work working with people who are have disabilities that are different than what we see in clinical mental health placements. So things like intellectual disabilities or autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
Yeah, so in Project Focus, you know, there are students in public schools identified for in special education services, and they receive services until they are age 21.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And at the upper end of that, transition for them to adult life has been really difficult. A lot of times they would end up in high school up to the age of 21, and by that time they're with lots of kids who aren't of their age anymore, right? They don't have appropriate social experiences anymore once they get past a certain age, if they're staying in high school that long. Fewer opportunities to learn appropriate skills for their daily life. And so to help with that transition process, Dr. McFarland has partnered with surrounding school districts so that students who are getting up to that upper age range can come to the University of Arizona and have a university experience amongst students who are their same age peers, and they're partnered up with one-on-one with a mentor. That mentor receives very specific training in working with people with autism and intellectual disabilities. They adapt curriculum for courses. They help students learn how to schedule their daily lives. And they have the students go around campus, hang out over at the student center, go to their classes, meet other kids, learn how to get from place to place on a schedule. It's a fabulous program. Yeah.
And how many students are in Project Focus?
At least 25, I believe. And when you think about that, it may not sound like a bunch, but when you start to multiply out how many mentors you need to get that done and the amount of training and the amount of support you need around that and the space you need for folks. And if you start thinking about all the other programs we have, it becomes quite a matrix of needs.
And are the students from your department?
The students who are mentors?
The students who are mentors.
Some of them are.
Some are. We have an undergraduate rehabilitation program, and I know that some of the students who are in that program tend to work for Project Focus. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is the students come from all over the university.
Yeah.
They have a vested interest in working with people who have disabilities and those who are of transition age. I think the common theme amongst that program, and frankly our department, is we want to see all people thrive, and transition's a really unique age. It is that shift from childhood into adulthood, and we know in voc rehab and vocational rehabilitation that transition age is a sweet spot. Because like Carl mentioned, we get at not just social development, but we get at the idea of post-secondary education or vocational training where somebody's able to independently work and really build upon their independent living skills, which is critical, crucial, and just an amazing thing for all of the people who are part of that program. Not just the students, but the people who are working with the students in the program.
And do students have more than one mentor working with them? Or is it one person who's assigned to them?
Yes. Yes.
And they help with the academics and the social?
They do. They do. They hang out with them and help them with the academics and the social.
That's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing.
And how long have you guys been doing this?
I've got to say, what do you think, Amanda?
Years, because I want to say at least the last three graduations, we've had classes of Project Focus students graduating.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, they do. They are part of the graduation ceremonies at the University of Arizona.
Oh, which is super cool.
It is excellent. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there's two other programs I want to ask you about. One is Project Poem.
Project Poem, and I can't give you as much detail on this maybe as I'd like to.
You can just give us a small overview, because I have another question after
That's great. So Dr. Songe Hong, he is a faculty member in our department. He is an internationally renowned individual working with folks who have visual impairments. And just a fascinating project where they have a program and a big summer program here where they are helping students who are blind and visually impaired, high school students, learn STEM skills and prepare them to come to universities to do in STEM fields. And so this summer, and then they spend, I think, a week up on Mount Lemmon doing science experiments with professors and sciences from the university.
Oh, great.
So it's a wonderful link outside of our department to our world-renowned sciences folks at the university.
That's amazing. Okay, so the last one is Arizona Teachers Academy.
Arizona Teachers Academy. That's not something that belongs to us. It's something that we're helping to implement. I don't know if you remember.
Oh.
You know. Robin knows. That's why we giggle. We giggle because we love. It was, how many, 3 years ago now? That at the State of the State address, the governor.
Promised it.
Ducey.
Yes. In response to teacher shortages.
Yeah, that we should make teacher education free. And it wasn't a couple months after that, near the end of the semester, that they reached out to the three universities and asked us to make it happen without any additional funding coming from the state. And our university and the other two state universities, they were willing to do that. It was really a wonderful thing. And they invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in student tuition for the last couple years to get students through our master's program in secondary education and our master's program in special education, mild moderate.
And to be in those programs, do you have to be an existing teacher?
No, actually. So these programs are bringing in new people. So the notion was there's a limited amount of funding available. It wasn't everybody that was in the program. So there was a limited amount of funding available. Most recently, we had funding for about 30 people. And you, if you received funding, then you worked for a year in Arizona schools afterwards. So the whole notion of this is to provide funding for people who are teaching in Arizona schools, likely to teach in Arizona schools, to help relieve some of this.
Oh, so they are existing teachers. No.
So they after they get out of the program, they have to teach for a year in an Arizona school.
That's a good deal.
It's a wonderful deal. Yes. And so that's changing now, because now it was set into state law, and the funding mechanism is going to change, and frankly, it's going to broaden it. So we'll be able to serve more than 30 students and broaden it out across all of our programs that in teacher education at the university. So that it's art, science, ag, special education, secondary, elementary, they'll all have access to some of these funds for Arizona Teachers Academy.
And so funds have started coming in from the state.
They will be available, yes. So we are setting up the mechanisms now, and folks should be hearing more about it in the coming months, and application deadlines will probably be in February or March.
Okay. And they can find out at the College of Ed website?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. One quick question for you.
Sure.
How do people find out about the Talk It Out program, the free counseling services for children and families? And also, I think it's so amazing that you're doing families also.
It's really so cool and exciting.
It's so unusual and smart.
It is, and we don't have caps on sessions. If you go to TUSD's website, if you contact either Terry Howard or Tammy Hilly, or even look up the Family Resource Centers through TUSD, you can find our information about the days that we have extended hours, and the contact, so that we can go ahead and get people scheduled if they would like services.
And also the turnaround is very quick on your program.
Yes. So we are trying to do better than what people would experience if they went elsewhere. And so if a referral is sent to us, we try to get back in contact with that person, parent, kid, whomever it is, within 2 to 3 days at a maximum, and have them scheduled as quickly as we can, pending we have a full caseload. But we also consider the need. So in our referral form, we have a marker that states high priority versus low priority. And we're very careful to make sure that for kids or family members who are high priority, we get them in for a service really quickly so that they have an intake and they have a touch point and they know that they're very much on our radar, and we want to make sure that they feel supported and they have that support.
And is there a connection between those counselors and the counselors on campus?
On campus being at U of A?
School they come from.
So what's lovely about this is because it is a communal joint program, we have access to the school counselor. And most of the time it's the school counselor and or the admin staff who are giving us the referral for the kid or the family member if it's not a self-referral. And so if there's ever a point where we need to have dialogue with the school counselor, we can do that without having to jump through hoops, which is wonderful because we have access to that person, especially when there's been a longstanding record between, let's say, a child and the school counselor. If the school counselor has been working with the kid for a long time and they're the one that put in that referral, more often than not, our students who are providing the mental health counseling service will talk with that school counselor. So it's really providing what should be an integrated model for treatment.
And what's also very nice about this is you can get a referral, a school counselor can refer, but also that you allow self-referrals.
We do.
So that is pretty amazing
it
and
is.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Did you have something you wanted to add? Oh, yes.
Oh, just about those services? Oh, no. You know, all I would add is that this is another one of those examples of the fact that I have fabulous, amazing faculty, not just doing So we've talked a lot about programs, but the thing I would add is that it's not just programs, but it's world-renowned research as well. So we have some of the greatest researchers in the world in working in special education. So they're not just implementing, but they're also developing knowledge in special education, school psychology, American Sign Language, and counseling.
You also housed or did have, I don't know how old they are now, some of the innovators in...
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. So I have this great picture. When I'm hiring people, I pull out this picture of our faculty from 1983, and I say, you know who this guy is? That's Sam Kirk. That's the man who coined the term learning disabilities. You know, this is Jim Chalfant, the man who came up with teacher learning groups so that we could assess kids at the school level and pull the right people in. That we've got Sid Bijou, the man who worked with Skinner and first applied behavior analysis techniques with children and described that so people could implement it. And I'll leave people out. I'll leave all the famous people out. The world-renowned gifted education program with June Maker.
You will, because there's only 20 seconds.
Oh, no.
So I want to thank you both for coming in. And I learned a lot. And it was really wonderful having the two of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And the College of Disability and Psychoeducational. Very lucky to have someone who's excited as their department as you. You're like, whoa.
I love it. I do love it.
Bye-bye.